Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 68. So we'll chant that verse together. Is that what you normally do? The verse that's on the board, you'll chant together. And then I just go through, just like Bhagavatam class. Okay, terrific. Tasmadyasya Mahabaho. Nigritani sarvasha indriyani indriartebhyas tasya pragya pratishtita tasmat. Therefore, O mighty armed, one whose senses are restrained from their objects is certainly of steady intelligence. Purport. One can curb the forces of sense gratification only by means of Krishna consciousness or engaging all the senses in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. As enemies are curbed by superior force, the senses can be similarly curbed not by any human endeavor, but only by keeping them engaged in the service of the Lord. When it was understood this, that only by Krishna consciousness is one really established in intelligence, and that one should practice this art under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, is called sadaka, or a suitable candidate for liberation. So, I notice it says here text 68 through 72. So, do you normally just read through all of them? Or how does it work? How do you usually do it? I mean, these, as I like, just because. Oh, okay. All right, so I'll read the translations for the rest of the chapter, and then I'll just start speaking. Okay. So 69 is, what is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled, and the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. Text 70. A person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve real peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires. Text 71. A person who has given up all desires for sense gratification, who lives free from desires, who has given up all sense of proprietorship and is devoid of all and is devoid of false ego, he alone can attain real peace. And last text 72. That is the way of the spiritual and godly life, after attaining which a man is not bewildered. If one is thus situated, even at the hour of death, one can enter into the kingdom of God. Okay, so, my notes out here. So this chapter is talking a lot about how we are not this material body. That's one of the main subjects of this chapter, at least the earlier part of the chapter, starting with verse 11, you know, where Krishna chastises Arjuna. He tells him, Asochanam vasochastvam pragyavalam chabashyase gatasum akadasum chan nanu sochandi panditaha. He says, well, speaking learned words, you are mourning for that which is not worthy of grief. The wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. And then he goes on to explain to him, Natu evaham jatu nasam natvam neme janadi pa nachaiva na bhavishyama sarve vayama takparam. He says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, Arjuna, nor in the future, or nor all these kings, nor in the future will any of us cease to be. Then the famous verse, Dehi no smenyata dehe komanam yovanam jara tata dehantara praptir diras tachanamuyate. As the embodied soul continually passes in this life from boyhood to youth to old age, similarly the soul passes on to another material body at the time of death, and the self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. And on. It goes like that, this same message is repeated by Krishna in so many different words up until verse approximately 30, I believe, in that chapter. So there's about, 17, almost 20 verses where Krishna is just giving that same instruction in so many different words. We're not the material body, right? And then there's a section in the middle of the chapter where Krishna kind of backs up a little bit and he gives all these other material arguments to Arjuna, why he should fight, because it's his duty as a Kshatriya. And if he doesn't fight, it'll look very bad. He'll, people will think he's a coward. He'll become infamous, etc. For some reason, Krishna as I said, he gives all these material arguments why Arjuna should fight. And then towards the, in this latter part of the chapter, he goes back, gets back on the spiritual platform. Well, actually, Arjuna asks a question. Arjuna asks the question, he says, I'm trying to remember the Sanskrit, but it's not coming. Prajahati yada kaman sarvam patagano gatan atmani amat. No, that's it. That. Anyway, I can't remember the Sanskrit. But he asked the question, what are the symptoms of a person whose consciousness is merged in transcendence? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? And how does he walk? And then Krishna answers that by saying, Prajahati yada kaman sarvam patagano gatan atmani eva manatushta stita pragyash tadochate. That. Well, a person who is who's become free from all desires for material sense gratification, which are born of mental concoction, and whose mind finds satisfaction in the self alone, he is situated in transcendental consciousness. And then the next from that was verse 54, 55, and then for the remainder of the chapter he elaborates on what are the symptoms of somebody who's situated in transcendental consciousness. So that's another almost 16 verses approximately, which brings us to the verses we just read tonight. So as I said, this whole chapter is really, it's the beginning of Krishna's instructions to Arjuna, and he's explaining to him how you're not this material body, you're actually an eternal spiritual being. And the chapter sort of concludes with, it's the first round, the first time Krishna gets around to telling Arjuna, actually, your constitutional position as my eternal servant. You're meant to engage in devotional service. So he's basically, he's saying this, he's stating this towards the end of this chapter. So a tremendous amount of emphasis is placed upon this teaching in this chapter, and for that matter, throughout the rest of the Bhagavad Gita. That's the main subject matter of the Bhagavad Gita. That we are not these material bodies, we're eternal spiritual beings, we're part and parcel of Krishna, and we're meant to engage in favorably in devotional service to Krishna. Jivera sarupahoi Krishnera nichadas. That was the instruction Lord Chaitanya gave to both Rupa and Sanatana Goswamis when he was instructing them, when he first met them. That the living entity, the jiva, jivera, swarupahoy, the eternal position or the constitutional position of the living entity is Krishnana Nityadas, is as the eternal servant of Krishna. So that's the basic teaching of Krishna consciousness. That's the foundation of bhakti yoga, that philosophical understanding that we are spiritual beings and we're the eternal servants of Krishna. So, having said that, I'd just like to make the point that, sometimes there's a lot of different religions throughout the world. We're familiar with the names. I won't even bother to name them. And they all have their beliefs. The Christians have their, I'm naming them here. Christians have their beliefs. The Muslims have their beliefs. The Jews have their beliefs. The Jains, here in India, you have the Jains. They all have a belief system. And somebody might think, you guys, it's just another belief system. You have, just like the Christians have their ideas and the Muslims have their ideas, you have your ideas. And it's okay, but it's just another set of ideas. It's just another set of beliefs. In other words, it's just your faith. But what I'd like to suggest tonight is that actually the ideas that are being presented here in the Bhagavad Gita are something more than just our faith. See? In other words, they can be supported. There's empiric evidence to support the ideas that are being presented in the Bhagavad Gita. For instance, this very point that's being made throughout this entire chapter, that we're not this material body, that we're actually eternal spiritual beings. There's actually empiric evidence to support that. And I'll give you, first of all, is everybody understanding? I'm not talking too fast. Because I know English is my first language, but it's not everybody who says, this is slow enough, and loud enough, you can hear what I'm saying? And okay, all right, good. Okay, so there is empiric evidence to support the worldview that's being presented here in the Bhagavad Gita. Specifically, that we're not this material body, that we're eternal spiritual beings like that. And I'll give you a couple examples of that. One example can be found in the recent research of a man who passed away about 2 years ago. His name was Ian Stevenson. He was the professor of the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia for many years. And for the last 30 years of his life, he did in-depth, comprehensive research with the phenomenon of children who have a spontaneous memory of a previous lifetime. In other words, these are kids who hit the age of like 2 years old, 3 years old. It happens between the ages of 2 and 4 years old when children, you know, are just starting to talk. They would describe that, you know, they would start talking about who they were in their past life. You see? You know, like they would say, they're talking to their parents. Actually, my other mommy was a better cook, and I liked the place where we lived a lot better. And then they say, what do you mean, other mommy? And, you know, they start describing all sorts of different things, you know, like in an indirect sort of a way. You know, as children, we'll do it with not like in a documentary form, but, you know, with all the emotions and everything. And anyway, the point being that when they would check out, you know, these researchers would be able to check out the story of these children, and they were presenting all sorts of verifiable details. I'll give you one example. There was this one child. She claimed that she was, it was here in India, you know, she claimed that she was a woman that had a little baby child named Minu, and she lived in a town called Bhatpar, and, you know, she was able to say, anyway, so, and she was continuously asking to be taken there. So finally, after doing some investigation, you know, about the case, they decided one day to take her to this village, and they got off at the train station, and this little child, she was just, you know, 2, 3 years old, she led the group of adults to the house where she formerly lived. She correctly identified her former husband, his brothers, his two brothers, you know, her mother-in-law, father-in-law, and the little baby child. And then she was able to point out in the house where different things were. You know, before, she said, when you go in there, you'll see this, you'll find that. My sewing machine was here, and it was all correct. She's presenting all these verifiable details, okay? I'm just giving you one example. This man wrote about 12 books in which he presented about 2,600 cases of this nature. And the reason there was only 2,600 is because how many cases can you study? You know, he made the comment that the cases were coming in faster than the researchers could follow up on them. And of those, 60 were, you know, had incredible, an incredible amount of verifiable details. And there were also some other significant things that a lot of times there was a correspondence between the way the person was killed in the previous life and birthmarks that they had in this lifetime. Like, for instance, a person might have been stabbed, you know, in the chest half a dozen times. And in the next lifetime, believe it or not, this person who they were claiming to have been, you know, the person in this lifetime would have, like, wounds in the same place, you know, birthmarks or scars in that same place, corresponding to the death mark wounds from the previous lifetime. So in this way, and this man's work, he's a scientist. You know, he was not a Buddhist. He was not a Hindu or anything like that. He had no religious agenda that he was trying to present. He was just doing this research as a scientist. And it was actually, his work was reviewed by the American Medical Association. The American Medical Association, for those of you who are not familiar, is about the straightest, most conservative, scientific, you know, medical body in the United States. The AMA, everybody, you know, they're so conservative, they're so straight. You know, they don't, for them to acknowledge this man's work really says something. And their statement was something to the effect that he's done a tremendous amount of very careful research, unemotionally, and his work cannot be something that can be, you know, brushed aside or overlooked like that. So they acknowledged that there was some validity to the work he was doing. Very interesting. So anyway, so that supports the idea. That supports specifically this information that we're receiving in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that there's a soul that's eternal that is continuing on from one body to the next. See? In other words, at the time of death, it doesn't all end, as modern science would have us believe. According to modern science, there is no such thing, there is no mind separate from the brain. The mind is a byproduct of a healthy working brain. In other words, if your brain, if you're alive and your brain is working properly, then there's the mind, you see? In other words, consciousness is generated by neural impulses. That's the, you know, the theoretical framework that modern science is working according to. And when the brain stops working, when your neural impulses stop generating, that's it. That's the end of the mind. That's the end of consciousness. At the time of death, that's finished. No longer, no more any experience. Okay? So that doesn't match up with this man's research. Similarly, just it's interesting to observe that it also doesn't match up with the worldview of either Christianity or Islam. Because they both believe that in Christianity, you die, you're judged, and then you either go to hell eternally or you go to heaven eternally. And the Muslims believe that you wait until the resurrection. There's a day of the final day of judgment. And at that time, the people are raised from the dead and they're judged. And then they either go to heaven or hell, like that. But once again, as I said, the empiric evidence seems to match up with the Vedic worldview as opposed to with the Islamic worldview or the Christian worldview or the scientific worldview. That's interesting. Bit of evidence that supports the idea that when something more than just this material body can be found in the phenomena of near-death or out-of-body experiences. So to explain that very simply, what that is this. Somebody has a heart attack or somebody's in a car accident or something like that, okay? They take them to the hospital to try to operate on them, and they find that this person is clinically dead, means that they put them up, you know, they put them on monitors. They have a way of monitoring the activity of your heart and a way of monitoring the activity of your brain. With the heart, it's called an ECG, an electrocardiogram. And with the brain, it's called an EEG, electroencephalogram. And these machines, they monitor the activity. So in the case of these people that I'm talking about who have these near-death or out-of-body experiences, there's no activity. There's no activity. The charts are flat. You see, in other words, there's no brain waves. There's no activity of the heart. This is very significant. In other words, that's why I'm saying they're clinically dead. Because even in a person who's under general anesthetic, there's activity of the brain and there's activity of the heart. Even a person who's in coma has some brain waves and some heart activity. So this is like even beyond that. You know, and coma is defined as a prolonged state of deep unconsciousness. So it's even, you know, they're flat. In other words, they're clinically dead. Okay, but here's what happens. Somehow or another, miraculously, the person, they do the operation and the person pulls out of it. You know, and after the operation, when they regain consciousness, they're able to describe what went on during that time when they were clinically dead, when there was no brain waves and no heartbeat. Now, when you have no brain waves and you have no heartbeat, according to modern medical science, you're unconscious. You're not experiencing anything. There's no question of you experiencing anything. Everybody follow me? Everybody understand what I'm saying? Okay, but these people are not only, you know, they're able to... Not only were they experiencing something, but they were able to describe in detail exactly what happened to them during that period while they were being operated on. They were able to, you know, go over the medical procedures in the correct sequential order that they happen, and they're able to even go as far as to say things that the different members of the medical staff were saying during the operation. This, you know, they're accurately describing exactly what transpired, both visually and orderly, you know, auditorially by the ear, what they saw and what they heard during that time. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because there is a mind, there is a mind that's separate from the brain. In other words, there's the gross material body and then there's the subtle body, you see? And sometimes the subtle body can, Sometimes the subtle body can bypass or override what's going on to the gross material body. It's obvious that what's going on here is these people are experiencing what's happening from their subtle body, you know, which is independent of, can be, experience things independent of the gross material body. And I'll give you an example of that, of how just how powerful this is. Some of these people, by the way, this is just like an interesting addition to this thing. Some of these people who have the out-of-body experiences, because, I'll back up a teeny little bit. Sometimes the objection is raised that, oh, no. These people, okay, they're experiencing that, but they're not really unconscious. Somehow or another, they're seeing the, you know, they're maybe seeing, here's the point. Sometimes this objection is being brought in sometimes that the people before they went unconscious, they were able to see something about the operating room and they just kind of made educated guesses about the rest of it, and everybody sees these kind of things going on television, so they just put the whole thing together and, you know, sometimes they get it a bit right. Something like that. It's a pretty lame objection, but that's the objection that's raised sometimes. Anyway, this one researcher, he specifically did a study of people who had out-of-body experiences who were congenitally blind. Congenitally blind means they're blind their whole lifetime. They're blind from birth. Okay? So these are people who are blind from birth. They've never had the experience of seeing anything. Okay? But some of these people, the man, his name was Kenneth Ring, and he did a study with 21 people. So of these 21 people who were congenitally blind, who had, you know, who had out-of-body experience, three of them said, no, they weren't seeing anything. Three of them said they weren't sure because, you know, they never experienced what sight is, so they couldn't say what they were experiencing was actually what you call sight. 15, the remaining 15 were completely adamant that they were seeing. And once again, they were able to present all sorts of verifiable details. So that's interesting. These people were blind from birth. In other words, their material eyes could not see. But when they were in this out-of-body state, they were able to see perfectly everything that was going on in the operating room. Now, here's something interesting. So what's going on here? They were seeing through the senses of the subtle body. The subtle body has its own senses. And as we have to understand that these gross senses that we're experiencing with, our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, touch, like that, They are a modified and restricted version of our subtle senses. In other words, they are our subtle senses, but covered over. You know, it's just like when you have a prism. You ever know what a prism is? You know, a prism? It's like glass, and it's like shaped like a pyramid. Jai, Shishi Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. It's glass, and it's shaped like a pyramid, and when they shine light through it at a particular angle, the light will come, it refracts, and it comes through the other sides of the prism in different colors, and you get all the different colors of the spectrum. In other words, so the light that's shining in there is pure white light, but due to the effect of the prism, it becomes modified and also restricted in a certain way. So that's what's happening. See, our pure consciousness, the pure consciousness of the soul, is being expressed first through the medium of the subtle body and then through the subtle senses and then through the medium of the gross body and the gross senses. So at each level, it is being restricted and modified. See, so what we're experiencing now in material life is the consciousness that we're experiencing now is a very restricted and modified version of pure spiritual consciousness. That's what's going on. So these people, when they're having the out-of-body experience, their experience that at least that first layer is removed, the gross body, and they're experiencing through the subtle senses. And actually, it's interesting because these people, the blind people, are actually able to see. And aside from that, some other just things that have been reported is that they're able to see not in just the location where their gross body is lying, but they're able to move at will to where they want to go. And there's like this one lady who's having an out-of-body experience, as she described it, she thought herself outside the room. In other words, she just desired to be outside the operating room and to see what was going on in another place. And then the next thing she knows, she's there. And there was two two instances of people who provided verifiable details of that they were actually able to change their location. One was a lady. She was in a hospital. She had an antibody experience. And she said, when she came back to consciousness, she said, you know, I thought this hospital was supposed to be a clean place. You have sick people coming here and you're operating, and it's supposed to be very clean and sanitary, but this hospital is filthy dirty. She said, on top of the chandeliers, you know, where the lights were, it's all very dusty up there. And she said, and outside on the window ledge, outside the window on such and such floor, there's a pair of old sneakers sitting there on the ledge. So they go, what? Yeah. Anyway, so they looked. Sure enough, they could see all the dirt on top of the fixture where in the operating room is like a big layer of dust because they never cleaned up there. And then but just to really check it out, they went out to the place where she was describing, and they tried to look out the windows and everything, but they couldn't really see out there. And it was like the point being nobody could actually get out there. But then one of the nurses, she went to a particular place where she was able to see that exact spot the lady was describing, and sure enough, there was this old pair of dirty tennis sneakers sitting on a ledge there. They must have fell out of one of the windows and wound up there. So there it was. Then there was this other lady, different operation. She was saying how she was describing all that was happening in the operating room during her out-of-body experience, and then she was describing how in the waiting room, her mother was there, and her mother was smoking cigarettes, And she said, that's strange because my mother doesn't smoke. So they were able to check that out. And sure enough, the mother was sitting with the sister, and they asked her, were you doing anything that you normally don't do, while you were in the waiting room there? And she said, I was smoking some cigarettes. And that's not normal for me because I don't smoke, but I was so nervous because, daughter was having this big serious operation. She said, but I was so nervous I had to smoke. So she was smoking cigarettes, and the lady who had the out-of-body experience was able to, say that. So, pretty interesting, pretty far out, but a clear indication that we are something more than just this gross material body, because here these people are experiencing through the subtle body. I'll give you a couple more examples about this that are interesting. That and that can be understood by this same analysis. There was a boy, I forget his name. He was a college student, and he was experiencing some problems in his health or this or that. He was a very bright student, by the way. So they went for a medical exam, and they found out he was severe headaches. He was experiencing severe headaches. So they took him for a medical exam, and they did some checks, and they detected he had a disease called hydroencephalitis, okay? And 95% of his brain was filled with water. He only had 5% of his brain left, okay? But he had 150 IQ. He had a genius IQ. So here was this person with practically no brain, right? But he had a genius IQ. Now, somebody might say, the objection could be raised, well, we only use everybody knows we only use a small percentage of our brain. So, he was a genius with even just using that 5% of his brain. I think there's some quote from Albert Einstein to the effect that we only use 10% of our brain. So somebody could, argue that one away like that. Okay, but maybe that's not the greatest example, but it's there. Anyway, here's a better example. Another example, okay? Another example is there is this boy. And you could actually, if those of you who have, which is everybody, you go on the internet, you can check this out for yourself. There's a boy, his name is Derek Paravicini. And what he is, he's a piano player. This boy is blind from birth, okay? And not only that, he is severely retarded, or I don't know if that's politically correct, autistic, retarded. He's very impaired. So much so that when he talks, he talks like this. And he's moving around. He's severely impaired. Okay, this boy cannot. He cannot live independently. He has to have like a nurse taking care of him. He can't, dress himself. He can't feed himself. But when he was very young, he was about 3 or 4 years old. They were taking him someplace, and there was a young child getting a piano lesson. Sitting on the bench and behind the piano, and as soon as he saw the piano, he ran up to where it was. He pushed the child that was sitting on the piano bench away, and he started playing the piano like an accomplished jazz pianist. Just like that. He never, nobody had ever seen him near a piano before in his life. Oops, sorry. In his short life, you know, he was only a young child. And there he was. He immediately just sat down at that piano, and he just started playing it like an accomplished jazz pianist. And to this day, he's doing that. He's got even better, you know, with some training and everything like that. But even right from that, from the get-go, he was playing like that. How do you understand that? Well, one way is that he obviously was a, you know, an advanced musician from a previous lifetime. Okay, that's there. But aside from that, how can we understand that somebody's blind? It's not easy to play the piano when you're blind. And very retarded, severely retarded. Well, what's happening? Once again, same explanation. That the subtle senses are the gross senses are getting their initiative from the subtle senses. So in certain cases, the subtle senses are bypassing or overriding or both the gross material senses. I think that's the explanation of that particular case. As well as in the case of that boy who had 95% of his brain destroyed by water. The subtle senses are bypassing and overriding the gross material senses. Now here's a couple more examples for you, okay? Along this point of, remember I mentioned about the congenitally blind people can see during the out-of-body experience because, they're seeing through the subtle senses. Okay, well, there's even examples of people who are congenitally blind who are seeing through subtle senses, even not in an out-of-body state. And these have been documented. There was this one, I forget which country it was in. This is in a book, by the way, called The Search for Vedic India by Dave and Rita Swami. That's where I read this just last night. And there was a Harvard professor, I forget his name, something like almost like Einstein, Einberg or something like that. Anyway, he did a study of these two Chinese twin sisters. They were both blind from birth, but he discovered that they were able to see, and this is going to sound really weird to you, but this man was a medical professor at Harvard University. These guys don't mess around. They got a lot at stake before they're going to say a lot of silly things to the general public. You know, they got their jobs at stake. And so anyway, these two Chinese sisters that he was investigating, they were able to see from the skin underneath their arms. In other words, when they lifted up their arms, they could see. They could see so much that they could read musical notes and they could distinguish between colors. Okay? That was one example. That was being reported, I said, by a medical professor at the University of Harvard, which is our top school in America. Okay? Another example was, this was studied, I can't remember who this was studied by, but there was another lady was able to see through her nose and her earlobes. You know, she was blind, but they put something in front of her nose and her earlobes, she could see. And then there was another case, and this case was done, this was investigated by the Russian Academy of Sciences in Russia, and it was, you know, it was so carefully researched and investigated that this actually appeared as an article in Time magazine, which, as many of you know, Time and Newsweek, they're like our two most mainstream, periodicals in America. Okay, this appeared as an article in Time magazine. This young lady was able to see through her fingertips. In other words, she was totally blind, but if you put a book in front of her or a photograph in front of her and she went like that, she could read by going, and she'd read it. Or she could describe what the person, looked like. They put a photograph in front of her of a man or a woman, and she goes like that, and she could tell it's a man. He's about 6 foot tall. She could describe it. She was seeing through her fingertips. So anyway, obviously, you know, they're not seeing through the gross senses. These subtle senses are there. So now another point, though, is that we're going to put this all in perspective now. The subtle senses, the subtle body, right, is actually like the gross body. It's a machine. It's not sentient. It's not animate. It's also a machine. It's just like, maybe, I hope this is an appropriate example, just like with a computer. You have the hardware and the software. So the gross senses are like the hardware, and the subtle senses are like your programs, you know, the software programs. Maybe something like that. I've heard that analogy given. So it's also not alive. You know, the subtle body is also a machine. And actually what the subtle senses are, as I mentioned, the gross senses are like a restricted and modified version of the subtle senses. Well, in the same way, the subtle senses are a restricted and modified version of the spiritual senses. Actually, I mentioned that at the beginning. And there's a verse that I can't remember where it's from, but it goes, Sarvo Pati Vinir Muktam Tat Pavart Tena Nirmalam Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchite. That's actually a verse, Rupa Goswami, maybe it's from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that book by Rupa Goswami, Nectar of Devotion, where he says that one has to become free from all designations, you know, from all different material conceptions about one's identity. And then Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. And then one has to engage with purified senses in the service of the master of the senses. You see? And that's actually what devotional service does. Devotional service, Cheto Darpanam Arjanam, Baba Mahadevagane Navapanam. The whole process, chanting Hare Krishna and the whole process of devotional service in general is a way of purifying the consciousness. And when the consciousness becomes purified completely, then we're able to serve Krishna with purified senses. You know, we have spiritual senses, right? And by the process of devotional service, we are purifying the consciousness of all the upadis, of all these different impure material associations, and then eventually we'll be able to serve Krishna with purified senses, or in other words, awakened spiritual senses, and that's pure devotional service. You see, when your senses can be totally purified, then your original spiritual senses become awakened, and then you're actually able to understand who you are, who Krishna is, and what your eternal spiritual relationship is with him. There's a nice verse, can't remember where it's from, it goes, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sabu Kabe Naya Shravaneti Sute Chitte Kore Daya, that pure love for Krishna is lying dormant within the heart of every living entity. But it's awakened by the process of devotional service. You see, so by Shravanadi Sute Chitte, which means by the process of hearing and chanting, the consciousness becomes purified. When the consciousness is purified, this love for Krishna, which is that's our original, you know, real condition, that becomes awakened, and then you serve Krishna with your awakened, purified spiritual senses in that state. So, just to mention this, if anybody's interested to, you know, in this way I'm presenting this subject matter, you know, you'd like more examples of how the subtle energy is working and its relationship to the gross material energy and the spiritual energy, a very good book for you to read is a book called Human Devolution. Some of you might be already familiar with that book. It's written by Drudhakarma Prabhu, disciple of Srila Prabhupada, who's doing a lot of nice preaching in this area. He wrote a book about 10 years ago, maybe it was longer now, called Forbidden Archaeology. And the basic theme of that book is that it was an attack on the worldview of modern archaeology, which is claiming that anatomically modern human beings have only been around on Earth for like 10 or 20,000 years. So what he did, and that's based on evidence from the fossil record. So what he did with another devotee, Sataputta, who unfortunately passed away only about 6 months ago, less perhaps. Anyway, they went back and they researched all the different reports of archaeological evidence that existed since the beginning of modern archaeology. It's only been around for like 150 years or so, you see. And they found that there was just as much evidence to support the antiquity of anatomically modern human beings as there was to support that, you know, the theory that they've only been around 10 to 20,000 years. But for some reason, these reports showing that, you know, anatomically modern human beings have been around 50,000, 100,000, 200,000, and even longer, I mean, even, be honest with you, even millions and millions of years ago, they were of equal quality, and just in terms of, like, you know, the criterion of scientific reports, but for some reason or another, you know, they've been swept under the carpet. You know, they've been brushed aside, and they were, you know, it's a phenomenon that goes on in science. It's called the filter of knowledge. In other words, you know, we like to think that we make a lot of observations, and then based on those observations, we formulate some sort of a theory, but it actually, according to even Albert Einstein, says nothing could become further, nothing is further from the truth. He says what happens is people get an idea in their head, you know, and then they try to find the evidence to support that. You know, there was one, and it's a well-known fact. That's how it works. See, so in other words, in science, that's how it works too. Somehow or another, they came up with this idea that anatomically modern human beings are only 10 or 20,000 years old. You know, maybe because it's flattering to our ego that we like to think that, you know, we are the pinnacle of evolution, right? And then all the evidence that supported that, oh, very good. That's welcome. You know, no careful examination, no scrutiny, just, oh, yeah, it supports the idea, so we want it. But all the evidence that, contradicts that, attack it, criticize it, ridicule it, and eventually just get rid of it, you know, which is what happened. There was one comedian in America, he was a very famous comedian, his name was Jimmy Durante. He had a big nose. Anyway, he said, I've already made up my mind. Don't try to confuse me with the facts. Everybody get it? I've already made up my mind. Don't try to confuse me with the facts. You know, that's how people operate. You know, they make up their mind, then whatever goes along with the conclusion they've already come to, you know, they've already jumped to the conclusion, that's welcome. But if something, you know, is in contrary to that or contradicts that, they don't want to know about it. That's how people work. Anyway, it's like that. I mean, it's kind of, everybody works like that. That's how human beings function. I mean, it's practical in a way because you can't always be, you know, you get a certain like paradigm and you operate within that, a certain conceptual framework. It's very difficult to be kind of, you know, at every moment taking everything into consideration and reevaluating your whole understanding of life. So you generally tend to lock into a particular, you know, way of thinking about things and understanding things, and then that's it. You know, and it's very hard to kind of get people to see things in a different way. But getting back to the class, the point. So, getting back to these things that happen, you know, these like some of those examples I mentioned. You know, people are very, when they hear about these things, actually, I'll have to back up a teeny little bit. Back around 150, 200 years ago, right around the same time that Charles Darwin came out with this theory of evolution, right around that same time, there were a group of scientists, mainstream scientists, not only mainstream scientists, but a few of the members of this group were Nobel Peace Prize winners, which is, that's the top prize you can get in science, okay? To mention a couple names, one was William Crookes. He was the inventor of the cathode ray tube. That's the tube that you use for televisions. That's your picture tube on a television, okay? And another member of the team was Sir Alfred Russel Wallace. He was the co-founder of the theory of evolution. He actually was just on the verge of publishing the theory of evolution, and he submitted his paper to Darwin, because they were colleagues, you know, to check it out. And Darwin, he'd actually been working on that theory for 10 years already. So when he saw that Wallace was just about ready to publish a paper about it, he freaked out and he consulted some of the other members, and then he got, with Wallace's permission, he published his book first. And that's why it's called Darwin's Theory of Evolution as opposed to Wallace's Theory of Evolution. Because in science, priority is everything. The first person to, you know, present the theory, they get the credit for it. Just like it was actually... Sir, what's his name? Chandra Bose? Bose? There's a famous, what? Subhas Chandra Bose, yeah. He was, I think it's different from the military person, but there's another, you know, or maybe it's the same man. Huh? Jagadish Chandra Bose, okay, yeah. Yeah, he was a famous inventor. He actually was the person who first discovered the radio. But somehow or another, I can't remember exactly how it happened. There, maybe if you know, you can tell. But Marconi, an Italian fellow, he actually found out about what Bose was doing, and he published it first. So Marconi is given credit for being the discoverer of the radio. But it was actually this fellow here in India who was the person who really discovered it first. So anyway, just an example of that. But when ordinary people, when they're confronted with these things like we were describing. Oh, yeah. Anyway, so these scientists... You know, getting back to the point, these mainstream famous scientists, they formulated this society called the Society for Psychical Research. Another member of the team was William James. He's considered the father of American psychology. Oh, yeah, Madame and Pierre Curie. Everybody, you know, anybody ever here go for an X-ray? Okay, they invented the X-ray. You know, they're both Nobel Prize winners for that, the husband and wife, okay? Anyway, what they observed, they went to these seances with spiritualistic mediums. These are people who are kind of like, somehow or another, were in touch with the subtle energy. And these mediums could do things like read people's minds. They could make objects move across the room. They could levitate objects. Well, that's kind of the same as moving them across the room. This is getting a little bit more fantastic, but this was observed by these scientists. They could make forms appear from nothing. Like there was this one medium, he'd be standing there, and he would just go into like a state of trance, and then a little ball of light would, you know, first appear on his body, then it would move away from his body, and it would develop height and width, and then it would gradually start materializing into a form, and then it would be a form. And the scientist was able to go up and touch it, and it actually, his hand didn't go through it. It actually had substance. I mean, I know this sounds weird. I know it sounds incredibly far out, but it was reported by, actually that one was reported by Sir William Crookes. He's a physicist and the inventor of the cathode ray tube. He was there for, you know, a seance when that medium actually did that. And there's many things like that happening. So, you know, the subtle energy is pretty amazing. Most people have no knowledge about it. That's the point I want to make. Most people are, due to the forces that be, you know, there's forces that control the knowledge that the common person has access to. You know, you'll never learn about what I just said. You'd never hear about that in school because, you know, there's reasons why they don't want people to know about these things, you know. That I won't go into that in this particular class. But in any event, so generally, because people have no knowledge of this, when they're confronted by this type of phenomena, they think, oh, it's a miracle. And they think somebody who could produce that is like maybe even God. Like, you know, for instance, there's a person here in India who can make ashes come out of his hand and wristwatches and gold things and like that. And there's a lot of people who, you know, they think he's God, right? You know? Of course, no, he's not. He does possibly have some little bit of mystic power. You know, there's anima, lagima, you know, everybody's familiar with that. There's these different mystic powers. He possibly has some of those mystic powers to some small degree, and that's why he's able to do that. Prabhupada even acknowledges, Prabhupada said that he was, in his childhood he had a guru, not Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, but another, you know, like a family priest or something like that. And this person, who Prabhupada held in pretty high regard, claimed that his guru was able to make pomegranates appear from Afghanistan. And as he once asked him, what do you want? And he said, I'd like some pomegranates from Afghanistan. Boom. He said, go look in the cupboard. There they are. And sure enough, they weren't there the minute before, you know, a few seconds before that, but there was a branch with freshly cut branch with pomegranates on it. So in other words, it's a mystic city. And sometimes people have it, but the problem is that it's not really that big a deal. I mean, all sorts of people sometimes can have these, you know, mystic powers. These mediums who are conducting these seances, they had it. And sometimes even demoniac people have these mystical powers. Actually, if you read in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's all sorts of descriptions of demoniac people having mystic powers. One very modern-day example of this can be found in the story with Bhaktivinoda Thakur. There's this very famous story where Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who's a magistrate, and here in India, there was this yogi. I'm probably going to pronounce his name wrong. It was something like can anybody know the name? You know, I can't remember his name, and I can't hear well enough to hear this devotee say it who knows it, but this yogi, he did have mystic powers. He could read people's minds. He was able to make fire appear from his hair and different things. So he had a whole big group of followers, right? And, you know, these people thought he was God because, you know, ordinary people, how can anybody do that unless they were God? He claimed he was God. He claimed he was Mahavishnu. And he was, you know, demonstrating these different mystic powers in different ways. He's healing the sick. You know, he was reading people's mind. He was healing people's diseases. He was making fire appear from his hair and other things, too. And he was claiming he was Mahavishnu. and that he was going to drive the British out of India and so forth and so on. And people, he had a big following. There was only one problem, though, you know. The problem was that he was seducing a lot of the women, you know. And anyway, this was brought to the attention of the British magistrate, and they didn't quite know how to deal with it, so they somehow, for some reason, they asked Bhaktivinoda Thakur to deal with it. And when he heard what he was doing, you know, how he was doing this immoral activity, and he was claiming he was Mahavishnu, Bhaktivinoda Thakur became determined that he was going to, you know, deal with this guy. So he went there, and he told him, you know, look, I know you're not Mahavishnu. I know you're just some yogi with some mystic powers. And actually didn't confront him to that, but he said, I know you're not Mahavishnu, and what you're doing is, you know, you're performing all these immoral activities, so we're going to arrest you. So anyway, so when he attempted to arrest the yogi, this yogi uses mystic powers to make all of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's family sick, almost to the point of dying. You know, they all came down immediately with this, a very high fever. And they were really, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself on different occasions was on the verge of death. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur wasn't shaken, because he knew. He had the conviction that, okay, this man obviously has some mystic powers, you know, but Krishna is Yogeshvara. Krishna is the master of all mystic powers. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur knew he had faith. He was taking shelter of Krishna, and he just had faith that Krishna was going to protect him. So sure enough, he persevered. And, you know, on the last day of the court case, because, you know, the case went to trial, and they had to bring Bhaktivinoda Thakur in on a stretcher. He was so weak and had such a high fever, you know. But somehow or another, he was able to, you know, go through the case. And they found this man guilty. And they cut his hair. And somehow or another, I don't know how, it can't explain it, but these mystic yogis, a lot of their power is kept within the hair somehow. So when this man's hair was cut, he immediately became very weak. And they took him to jail, and they imprisoned him. And sometime shortly after that, he committed suicide. But anyway, the point being that, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was not, he was, as a great devotee, he was not fazed by the whole thing. He understood these mystic powers for what they were. They're material. They're material. They are mystical. They are something, you know, a manifestation of a higher subtle energy. But they're not, what to speak of being spiritual, they're not even necessarily pious. There's further evidence of that, as I mentioned. Even if you read through the Bhagavatam, even demons or people who are behaving demonically have these powers. The classic example of this is Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni, everybody knows that story, so I'll just kind of very, very briefly go over it. Durvasa Muni was a great mystic yogi. Actually, I think he's considered a qualitative incarnation of Lord Shiva. So he became envious of Maharaj Ambarish, who was just a king. He was a devotee, but he was just an ordinary earthly king, because Maharaj Ambarish had a great reputation, and he was even becoming, you know, more famous than Durvasa Muni, who was this great, big, powerful yogi. So Durvasa Muni devised a plan to try to, he was looking for an excuse to punish him, to get angry with him. So he showed up with all his disciples to his place, and then Maharaj Ambarish had been fasting for 1 year. He'd been doing an Ekadasi fast for 1 year, and it was, you know, Durvasa Muni showed up with 60,000 disciples. He went to take bath, you know, down at the river, and Maharaj Ambarish didn't know what to do, because the time to break his fast had come. But he knew, if I break my fast before I feed my guest, that's a big offense. But then if I don't break the fast, I've been fasting for 1 year, and if I don't break it during, you know, from this time, in between this time and this time, then I fasted for 1 year in vain. You know, I lose all the benefit. I don't get the benefit of having to perform this austerity. So he consulted his Brahmins, and the Brahmins said, okay, no, look, what you do is just drink some water. Drinking water is breaking a fast, and it's also not considered breaking a fast. It's acceptable, you know. So he did that on the advice of the Brahmins. But when Durvasa Muni came back, he was outraged. Oh, where is your etiquette, you know? You've broken the fast. You drank water before you. Anyway, so he's very angry. He pulled the hair out of his head, threw it to the ground, and he created this big demon, you know, which started rushing towards Maharaj Ambarish to kill him, you know. But Maharaj Ambarish, he was not a mystic yogi. He thought, okay, well, this is it. Looks like I'm going to get killed here. So he just took shelter of Krishna by remembering Krishna and chanting Hare Krishna. And what happened was the Sudarshan Chakra came and killed the demon, you know, and proceeded to pursue Durvasa Muni. And Durvasa Muni fled. Everybody knows the story. As I said, he went to Lord Shiva for protection, and then Lord Ram. They all told him, we can't give you protection. Finally, he even went to Lord Vishnu to ask for protection. And Lord Vishnu said, you've offended my devotees. I can't give you protection. And Durvasa Muni was pleading, what can I do? He said, well, if Maharaj Ambarish excuses you, if he forgives you for the offense, then you can be forgiven. So then he humbled up pretty quick, and he went back to where Maharaj Ambarish was, and he, you know, offered dandavats, and he begged him to forgive him for his great offense. And Maharaj Ambarish was so humble, he said, offense? What are you talking about, offense? I'm the one who was offensive. He was so humble like that. And he said, he actually went as far as to say, you know, not only have you not offended me, but I've offended you, but if I have any pious activities, I give you the credit of all my pious activities like that. Anyway, so he did forgive him. So the Sudarshan Chakra stopped chasing Durvasa Muni. But, you know, the idea is that Krishna's Yogeshvara, here is Durvasa Muni. He had mystic powers almost on the level of Lord Shiva, being a qualitative incarnation of Lord Shiva. But, you know, look how he was trying to use him to destroy a pure devotee. Of course, he wasn't able to do that. But so the point, I guess, it's 8:30 now. What time is class ends at 8:30? So it's right around time. This is the final point I want to make, that we shouldn't be impressed by this exhibition of these, you know, the subtle body, which manifests itself in these mystic powers. We shouldn't be impressed by that. They are material. And sometimes, as I said, they're not even used in a pious way. A lot of times they're used in a very demoniac way. Actually, I'll give you one last example to make this point, you know, how it's not such an impressive thing. Has everybody here or anybody here read Radhanath Maharaj's book, Journey Home? Some of you, about half, have read that book. Okay, in the book, Maharaj tells us one story about how when he finally arrived in India, probably on the same day he arrived, there was this big conference, a world conference of spiritual people. And at this conference, there was 800 yogis. These were people who had, you know, come down from the Himalayas. Some of them, they said, were hundreds of years old. And, you know, they hadn't been in civilization for who knows how long. But somehow or another, the person who was, you know, organizing this festival, this conference, was able to get them all to come. So they all were there, and, you know, and people were going around and, you know, meeting them and getting their darshans. And actually, some of them were, you know, displaying their different mystic powers. Maharaj saw several exhibitions of mystic powers from some of these yogis right there at that conference. But what happened, a funny thing happened at the end of the conference. What happened was on the last day of the conference, they were having like a big pandal program, and all these different, you know, yogis were coming up and getting a chance to speak. But unfortunately, what happened was the organizer of the conference got a letter saying it was a death threat. The letter stated that they were going to come at some point in the evening, and they were going to kill all the yogis present, and a lot of the, you know, they were going to terrorize the entire conference. So the organizer of the festival, he decided that, you know, we're going to have to wrap this up at a certain time, get everybody out of here. They didn't want to take the chance, run the risk of having the thing continue going, you know, around the time when the letter said that they were going to come and, you know, do this terrorist activity. So and he told everybody it was going to have to stop at 7:00. He, you know, warned them. But then when 7:00 rolled around, he took the microphone and he said, "Okay, that's all we have time for. Now we're going to have to close the conference." And what happened was a lot of the yogis didn't have a chance to speak. You see, so they couldn't. Their false egos got the better of them. What they did was they ran up and they tried to. They didn't try. They actually did. They grabbed the microphone out of his hand, and some of them, you know, they were competing. They were fighting for the microphone, you know, so they could, you know, because they wanted to have the opportunity to speak. And one yogi was struggling, and they was fighting with, you know, they were grappling, practically wrestling with each other to get the microphone. And one finally grabbed the microphone, and he was raving like, you know, probably like a madman, you know, saying all these different things. Anyway, finally, the organizer of the festival was able to get up there. He got up again, you know, and he was able to disconnect the wire from the microphone. And you know, that was the end of the conference. But the point being that, you know, here were these different yogis. Some of them had mystic powers, but they weren't free from the false ego, you know, because, you know, when they were deprived of their opportunity to speak, what happened? They started fighting like cats and dogs. And see, so, you know, where is the, you know, where's the sadachar, you know, where's the adhikar, where's the elevated spiritual qualities? You know, when they were deprived of the opportunity to speak, they started fighting just like ordinary people out on the street fight over, you know, somebody whose taxi cab it's going to be or something like that, you know. So anyway, so we shouldn't be at all impressed by these mystic yogic powers. We shouldn't be bewildered by them. We shouldn't be desiring them. They're not very important. They're material. And actually, Prabhupada said in one lecture, he gave more than one lecture, he made the point that devotees particularly don't need to be concerned about these things, because when there's a need for some sort of like extraordinary display of potency, Krishna is Yogeshwara. He's the master of all mystic powers, and he'll supply that. Prabhupada is a great example of that. You know, Prabhupada is the greatest example of that. When you know, some sort of mystic type of activity was required for it to happen, Prabhupada, you know, didn't like a yogi will things to happen, but he just depended upon Krishna, and Krishna made it happen. Here in Mumbai, the incredible struggle to get the land at Juhu Beach, Prabhupada had this incredible struggle with this man, Mr. Nair. Everybody, you might have read the story in the Prabhupada's Leelamrita. So this man was very powerful. You know, I think if I remember correctly, he was the owner of a newspaper, and he had all sorts of connections. You know, he was very, very well connected in Bombay. He was connected with the chief of the police or the commissioner of the police and all sorts of other people, you know. So by different intrigues, he was trying to cheat Prabhupada from the land. He took the deposit, and I can't remember all the ins and outs of the whole thing, but he was basically trying to cheat the devotees out of the money and take the land and not give them the land. So Prabhupada fought tooth and nail. You know, he wasn't going to let this man get away with it. At least he wasn't going to let him cheat him out of the money. The deposit was something like equivalent to $50,000, you know, which was a lot of money back in those days. Still a lot of money, but it was even more, worth a lot more even back then. So Prabhupada was not about to allow his society be cheated like that. So at one point he was demanding, okay, look, if you're not going to give us the land, give us back the deposit. You know, and you can have your land, you know, like that. Anyway, so it went back and forth like that. But the man was really determined to try to cheat, you know, Prabhupada. He wanted to keep the money and not give the land. So Prabhupada kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And at one point, you know, Prabhupada was, you know, it was becoming very, like, intense. And Prabhupada, oh, yeah. And then what happened is right in the heat of the whole thing, this man got a heart attack. He got a heart attack. And he passed away. He had a massive heart attack, and he passed away. So Prabhupada confided in the devotees that afterwards, it was such a hellish, you know, struggle. He said, I never did this before, but I was praying to Krishna to somehow or another take this man out of the picture. So, and Krishna did it. So, you know, devotee doesn't have to, Krishna does the work. Krishna does what's required. And also, you know, we're not, well, one other thing. Prabhupada once was asked to make a display of some mystic power. He was asked by somebody, what miraculous thing have you done? And he pointed to his disciples and he said, here, this is my miracle. These people here, it's just a few short years ago, all these people, they didn't know who Krishna was. They had no interest in spiritual life. They were all taking intoxication and eating meat, gambling, and engaging in illicit sex. And here they are just a few short years later, and they're all, you know, engaging in pure devotional service like that. So that's my miracle, that these, you know, totally materialistic people have been transformed into such nice devotees of Krishna. That's the kind of mystic power we're interested in. So anyway, so there's that verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, in all activities, just depend upon me and act fully under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. And then he goes on to say, much chitta sarva durgani mat prasada tadishyasi. He says, if you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditional life by my grace. So that's a devotee's meditation. We just have to become fully Krishna conscious, and then by the grace of Krishna, we'll pass over all the, Krishna will take care of everything. You know, we don't have to make any separate endeavor. Just engage favorably in devotional service, and Krishna will take care of all the different, you know, things that need to be taken care of in our life. There's another nice verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, "Ananyas chintayanto mam ye jana pariupashyate tesham nichabayuktanam yogakshemam bahamiham." He says, to those who are meditating on my transcendental form without deviation, to them I preserve what they have and I carry what they lack. You see, so you know, as Krishna becomes involved in your life and he reciprocates, and he takes care of everything. He preserves what you have. He carries what you lack. But it's so. What is? But to take shelter of Krishna is very practical. It's not some sort of sentimental thing. There's a process for surrendering to Krishna. It's described in once again in the either in the Hari Bhakti Vilasa or the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And there's six steps to it. And the first step is you accept everything that's favorable. The second step is you reject everything that's unfavorable. And that it goes on like that. So you know, it's a practical thing. It's not some sentimental thing. Surrendering to Krishna, taking shelter of Krishna. Actually, it's very nicely, one sentence is of how one of the first steps in surrendering to Krishna is very nicely described here in this one of these verses here. Prabhupada says here, a Krishna conscious man, it's referring to this verse here. It's talking about how it says a person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires which enter like rivers into the ocean, which is always being filled, and yet at the same time it remains still. It says, he alone can achieve real peace, not the man who strives to satisfy these desires. Okay, so in the purport to that verse, Prabhupada says, this is the proof of a Krishna-conscious man, one who has lost all inclinations for material sense gratification, although the desires are present. And I remember, you know, for a long time when I used to read that sentence, I'll read it again. It says, this is the proof of a Krishna-conscious man, one who has lost all inclination for material sense gratification, although the desires are present. I used to read that sentence, and I used to scratch my head and go, wait a second, that sounds like a contradiction to me. How is it possible? The first phrase of the sentence is saying you lost all inclinations for material sense gratification, and then in the very next phrase of the sentence is saying, but the desires are present. That sounds like a contradiction. What's going on here? How do I understand that? Then I can't remember if I just one day understood it, if Krishna just revealed it to me, or if somebody explained it. But the correct way to understand that is this. The material mind is always desiring sense gratification. That's the nature of the mind. It's always desiring sense gratification, see? So until you become like a Paramahamsa, until you're totally beyond the material impasse, it's just the nature of the mind. It's just desiring that, desire like that. But with the intelligence, we should have the conviction by understanding this philosophy, we should have the conviction that I am the eternal servant of Krishna. I'm not this material body. I'm the eternal servant of Krishna. So based on intelligent conviction, we should lose all inclination for sense gratification. See, notes, we should be, our will is that, no, I don't want sense gratification. The mind's going to keep desiring. It's just because that's just the way it works, you see. But our intelligent determination is based upon the philosophical understanding that we're not this material body, that we're the eternal servants of Krishna, is that we don't want to have anything to do with material sense gratification because we understand it's binding us. It's keeping us here in this material world. It's forcing us to stay in the cycle of repeated birth and death through 8,400,000 species of life. See, so our intelligent conviction is based on our gyan, our knowledge, is that we don't want to have anything to do with it. But despite that fact, the mind will keep desiring it. So what we have to do is we have to, as stated in the last verse of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, evam bhude param budva samstab yatmanam atmanam jahi satram mahabaho kama rupa darasadam. It says, the instruction is given, thus knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind, like that, one should control the lower self by the higher self, and thus, but with spiritual strength, conquer the sensational enemy known as lust. In other words, like Radhanath Maharaj, he actually made this point the Sunday before that, when he was giving class here in the morning. He says, you just have to use your intelligence and make the correct choices. He says, he actually made the point, ironically enough, he's making the point, you don't have to go to the Himalayas, you don't have to go any place. You can become Krishna conscious, you can become a pure devotee right here in Mumbai, or, you know, Prabhupada in a lecture he gave in Los Angeles said right there in Los Angeles, any place, all you have to do is just use your intelligence and apply this philosophy by making the intelligent decisions, you know, applying this philosophy in your life, you control the mind. You just don't listen to the mind. You see, you listen to your intelligence. And that's what's meant by losing all inclinations for sense gratification, although the desires are present. And that's also the way to take shelter of Krishna. When you hear this expression, we have to surrender to Krishna, we have to take shelter of Krishna. Practically speaking, that's what's meant by that. That you study this philosophy, you become absorbed, you really understand it inside and out. Prabhupada said that a devotee should know these books like a lawyer knows his law books, you know, or a doctor knows his medical books. We should really try to understand this philosophy. Prabhupada actually said we should study my books scrutinizingly and try to understand this philosophy from different angles of vision, like that. So, and by doing that, the intelligence becomes strengthened. You develop spiritual intelligence, and then you're able to, you know, manage your life according to your intelligence, and that's surrendering to Krishna. That's taking shelter of Krishna. And if we do like that, and, you know, repeatedly, it's not a static thing, it's a dynamic thing. It's something you're doing at every moment. From now until the moment you leave your body, you have to do that. Sounds like a lot of work. It is, but it's worth it. Just at every moment, we have to try to not listen to the mind when it's telling us to, you know, pursue material sense gratification, but rather know what we should be doing based upon the instructions we're receiving from the spiritual master and the scriptures. That's called, you know, using your intelligence, and put that into practice. And by doing that, we are going to make progress. We'll just keep progressing more and more towards pure devotional service. And Krishna will reciprocate by eventually freeing us from all these material desires, but he'll reciprocate in so many other ways too. He'll reciprocate by helping us in so many different ways. Actually, and this is the end of the class, I'll just end it by quoting the famous verse, Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam pratipurvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upiyanti te tesham eva anukampartam tesham eva anukampartam aham agyana jamtamaha nasyami atmabhavashto gyana dipena bhashvata. Krishna says, to those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love. It's just another way of saying, to those who are constantly using their intelligence, applying what they've learned from their spiritual master in their life, okay? That's what's meant by being constantly devoted and doing it, not resentfully, but doing it, you know, with appreciation, you know, for what's been given to us, okay? Somebody who's done that constantly, Krishna says to them, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. Krishna will inspire you from within your heart. He'll enable you to understand what you should be doing, what you shouldn't be doing, you know, where you should be, where you shouldn't be, like that. And then the further result was Krishna says, out of compassion for them, I, dwelling within their heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. And Krishna will gradually enlighten us so that eventually we'll understand what our swarup is, what our eternal spiritual relationship with Krishna is. It can happen all of a sudden. Prabhupada said, actually, you can become Krishna conscious all of a sudden. Generally, it doesn't work like that. For most of us, it's a gradual process. Just like, I don't know if you have them here in India. In America, we have something called a dimmer. It's a light switch, but it's unlike an ordinary light switch. It doesn't just turn on or off. It gives you gradations of light. So in other words, if you want, you can. It's like a fan. You know, it's like with the control on the fan. You can make the fan spin slow, or you could turn it and make the fan spin so fast you feel like you're in a helicopter and it's about to take off. You know, it's the same thing with. It's the same sort of a switch, but on light. So you can make the light very bright, or you can turn it down. You see, so it's like that. Krishna has his hand on the dimmer, and as we surrender to Krishna, as we more and more try to, you know, serve him favorably, Krishna just turns that dimmer. And you become more and more Krishna conscious, you become more and more enlightened. Oh, Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Thank you.